Today, it's Wednesday, the 24th, 2018, the Resources Committee meeting of the State House. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:01 p.m. Members present so far are Representative Birch, Representative Parrish, Co-Chair Garen Tarr, myself, Co-Chair Andy Josephson, and Representative Drummond. And we should let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Max Stanley. Welcome, Representative Tuck, and who's our alternate and is joining us. I'd like to remind members to please silence their cell phones. This afternoon, we will hear an update from the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. There were a couple articles in the Dispatch News in the last 24 hours that members may want to look for or read. They're going to report on the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project. I'd like to welcome Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation President Keith Meyer, Senior Vice President for Project Management Frank Richards, and Vice President for Commercial and Economics. But before we do that, my co-chair has a brief housekeeping thing that she'd like to take up relative to House Bill 288.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just passed out a handout, and we'll update the slide deck online. But yesterday, when I did an example in terms of looking at the value of the royalty versus the taxable barrels, I had one example where I combined them, and as I thought about it later, that's not the most appropriate way to show it because a barrel is only going to be a taxable barrel or a royalty barrel. It's only going to have one value to it. So I just updated this chart, and in advance of Ken Alper's presentation today, wanted to pass it out, so we'll update that. And it just gives some examples of, for example, the 20,000 barrel example we used was because that's the increase in production that we've seen for year over year most recently, and then gives a 50,000 and 100,000 barrel example and what that might mean in terms of value for the royalty oil and the taxable barrels, and then the total value, just to give people some numbers to kind of look off of. But like I say, it was just more thinking about it last night. I thought that's probably not the best way to illustrate that point. We're just going to leave that at this today. I wanted to mention it to folks that we'll update the slide deck. And then just, keep this in mind for the conversation on Friday because we have so much to get through today. We don't want to divert from that.
So members are encouraged to bring that spreadsheet to the hearing on Friday. I'd like to recognize that Representative Tallarico has joined us at 1:03, and I'd like to recognize that Representative Chenault is in the audience and has joined the hearing. So at this time, I would invite up President Meyer, Vice President Richards, and Ms. Wilcox, if you'd like to come up as well, and put yourselves on record and begin your presentation. One thing is for the members, I see that this is a fairly lengthy slide deck. We have an hour and 55 minutes, which is a chunk of time, but we need to be watchful of that. Gentlemen and lady, if you will.
All right, thank you very much. Keith Meyer, President of AGDC.
For the record, Frank Richards, Senior Vice President of AGDC.
And Lisa Wilcox, Vice President of AGDC.
Okay, if I, through the chair, if I may begin.
You may.
All right, thank you very much for having us. We're going to give an overview of the project today, but we really wanted to drill down on some numbers to start to better explain the numbers. That's been one of the questions, the requests of us. So rather than put that in the middle or the back, we decided to bring that right up front. And so the first set of slides, we'll talk about the budget, and then we'll really drill down into the the economics of the project.
Please proceed.
On the budget, that's slide 3. So this is our capital budget variance analysis. This looks at December. So this was December of 2017, so all of 2017. We're significantly underspending. If you look at the comments on the right, we've had a significant austerity program. We implemented that really in 2017. In order to extend our existing funding for as long as we could. And what we've tried to do, and I think I've said this early on, is that we're really looking at the allocation that the state has given us as sort of our allotment, and we want to live within that, and we want to take that as far as we can before we have to request additional funding. But ideally, we also want to set up a structure such that third parties can invest in the project and therefore put the state in a position where it has the option to invest, but not necessarily the requirement. So this is reflective of that that program. So we've again significantly underspent what was the budget in 2017.
All right. And let the record reflect that Representative Rauscher and Representative Johnson have joined us at 105. President Meyer.
If I could go on then, the next slide, slide four, looks at our fund balance and a forecast for the later half of FY18. And so January through June, we've got an expenditure there. About $67 million would be our total expenditure for that time. If you look down at the bottom set of numbers, that is the fund balance. The fund balance starting in January is about $72 million. We'll get down to the end of January about $67 million. We've got a burn rate of about five or so. So we expect to end in fiscal year 18 with a balance of about $41 million. We expect that then to be able to carry us through much of FY19 under our current burn rate.
Okay. And just wanted to recognize that Representative Knopf has joined us. Thank you.
Next page, page five, looks at our FY 2019 operating budget request. We have not requested additional funding. There was no additional appropriation. We are requesting the ability to receive funds from third parties, so a program receipt authority. And then also to transfer some funds from the in-state project, which will be wrapping up, to the Alaska LNG fund. And so you can see the table there just shows our expenditures are the same in FY18 as we've proposed for FY19. And as we look forward,
we'll pause briefly for a question from Representative Johnson.
So your request to thank you, Mr. Chair. So your request to receive program receipt authority, I mean, to who are you thinking you will be receiving? What are you setting that up for exactly?
Such that we could receive funds from third parties for the continuation of the project, up to and including the entire project. And so what we'll be looking for in 2018 calendar year, this year, is really to put together an offering package for third-party investors such that we can receive funds from third parties to conduct additional development work, including additional feed work, and potentially even all the way up through construction.
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering, and who would you anticipate being involved with that?
Well, I think this is going to be an attractive project for infrastructure investors. So that's like pipeline companies, could be pension funds, could be insurance companies, could be our foreign customer investors or related parties like that. But I think we will have a project here, an investment here that will be attractive to infrastructure investors. It will not meet the hurdle rate of an oil company. I do not expect the oil companies to jump into a pipeline project. They're not involved in pipelines because the returns are too low, but modest enough for pipeline companies and other infrastructure investors.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Yeah, thank you. So what I'm hearing is Sinopec could be a third-party investor at this point.
Yes, they could be.
If there's receipt authority given.
Or other customer types.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I was wondering. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell us a little bit about the in-state project, the 1229 ISP fund?
About the project itself or where we stand on that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, if I could turn that to Frank, sure. And he'll give a very brief and concise description.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish again, Frank Richards. The Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project is what we have been advancing, utilizing the 1229 or the In-State Pipeline Fund. That project has been moving through the regulatory process with the Army Corps as the lead federal agency. They have went through a draft supplemental environmental impact statement last summer. They went through public review and comments. They are now in the final stages of completing that. We hope to receive a final supplemental environmental impact statement process to be published in the Federal Register in March, and then a record of decision that will come to AGDC in the June timeframe. So that would be the completion of that regulatory work for the in-state project.
Follow up, Representative Perry.
And then the $12 million you're expecting to be remaining in that, you'd like to switch over to the LNG fund, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, at that time, at the end of, say, fiscal year 18, with the record of decision in hand, that was our goal to be able to achieve that. So the focus of the corporation is the Alaska LNG project, and we'd like to be able to then utilize those funds through a fund transfer to advance that project.
Yes, and a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a slightly other note, for the program receipt authority, it's my understanding you're expecting all non-Alaska state government sources for that. Is that correct?
I'll take that one. No, I would say that that there could be Alaskan sources, and in fact, SB 138 requires that we have a structure that we make this available to Alaskans, municipalities, and regional corporations. So we intend to do that, and that would probably even be one of the early rounds.
And a follow-up on that point?
But no state government agencies, just, it sounds like, private or tribal government municipal sources.
Well, if I may, through the chair, I don't see us excluding anyone, if that's what you mean. To me, this would be an offering to all of Alaskans. So I'm not sure exactly the nature of the question, but I don't see us saying that such and such a group cannot invest. But we're not looking at it being a requirement. Am I missing that question? And Frank wants to chime in, so he may have a better feel.
Mr. Richards, you want to?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I believe the question that the representative is asking is whether or not we're requiring the state of Alaska to contribute funds. And so with the request for receipt authorities, again, giving us the ability through the legislature to receive those outside funds. We do not have in the fiscal 19 budget any additional ask for appropriations from the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was some mention of potential program receipt authority. I think you talked about retirement funds, if you're pension funds, if you will. And I think the governor had, if my memory serves, the governor made some mention about the Alaska retirement, the PERS, public employee retirement system, potentially being permitted or as a prospective investor. And I don't remember in that circumstance, but has any of that discussion happened? So when it's opened up for program receipt authority, does that just basically green light that investment option?
Through the chair, again, we're not looking at any kind of exclusion or restriction. So mm-hmm. to me, it green lights our ability to receive funds from third parties. I think pension funds are an ideal investor in infrastructure, and I'd love to see them. We have not had discussions with them, in any kind of specificity or really at all with respect to the pension funds. However, this will be a long-term stable investment with mm-hmm. a significant upside at the end. So I think it's a perfect investment for retirement funds, pension funds, insurance companies.
Well, just as a follow-up, I'd say that gives me a great deal of concern because looking at it from the state perspective, and I know there's been a lot of discussion about the potential investment through, for the permanent fund somehow or another. I'll be looking very closely at that program receipt authority and, what sort of latitude exists there. But this is helpful. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we were on page 5, President Meyer.
Okay, one more on the question.
Sorry, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know I've asked this question before, but I want to go ahead and ask it again. So with the program receipt authority, that will not mean there's buy-in to the actual ADDC corporation itself.
Through the chair, correct. That is the current anticipation. So more particularly, we're looking at a project company that would hold the assets. Investors would come into that project company, not own a piece of AGDC. So currently we're envisioning that AGDC would stay 100% state-owned, not have third-party investors.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the budget slide 6. So this looks at future funding needs or funding desires. Those needs and desires are related to schedule. So the more funding we spend, the more we can either keep or accelerate the schedule. We're in deliberative stage with the board on this, so it's not that we've got an approved budget or any of that. This spend profile that we're looking at right now, which has a significant number for the Class 3 work, which is leading to that lump sum turnkey or the feed kind of a number, keeps us on track for our 24-25 in-service timing. So that's what we're looking to really go out on the street with initially for third parties. Again, the intention there is really to do some the feed work as well as future development work that would keep us on track. This stops short of doing any long lead procurement, which would be a further accelerant to the schedule.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're going to get into this a little bit later in the slide, but just one of the significant milestones that's been met was responding to all of the FERC information requests. And I just thought this might be a good opportunity for you to sort of just speak to that early in the meeting and then also, just kind of reflect on how you were able to accomplish that with the sort of constraints on your budget and being, sort of the mindful, if you will, of stretching those dollars.
All right, Co-Chair Tarr, thank you very much. Let me say a couple words, and I'll turn it over to Frank. But to me, that's an example of AGDC working with its team and with a minimal use of contractors. So we were still under an austerity program, answered 801 questions, many thousands of pages, 6 months of work. We finalized those. Was it Monday or last week?
Monday.
Got those finally in, so that's a big step in the FERC process, but why don't you take a couple accolades there as well?
So, again, as Keith said, we pushed hard in 2017 on the regulatory front, primarily to try and de-risk the project because, again, working in Alaska, the environmental regulatory issues can, derail the project and add a significant amount of time. So we wanted to apply to FERC, which we did in April. FERC then responded back to that application and said, we have some more specific questions we'd like you to address. So that's what the 801 questions were about. It was about what they felt where they needed more information. The team in AGDC has been working on the ASAP project with those same federal regulators and have a very good working knowledge of the issues and how to address them. So it's a very small, very nimble, very energetic, and very professional group that was then able to coalesce to work towards accomplishing these and providing the answers in a very short period of time, 6 months from initiation to completion, because, again, it's going back and making sure that we're addressing issues that have regulatory and statutory in nature and that would allow FERC to be able to go into their National Environmental Policy Act or NEPA process to conduct an EIS. So we want to give them the best information so that they can do the work and do it in an expedited time frame, because we're asking them to essentially complete this in a year's time. So kudos to the team of professionals within the regulatory group at AGDC, because they were able to knock it out of the park.
And just one follow-up, if I may, through the chair or co-chair. When we stepped into the lead of this project, we took over a filing that had about 36,000 pages. We filed on April 17th of 2017. We're now at about 100,000 pages on that. So we've done an enormous amount of work, very, very complete responses. So we're pretty proud of that accomplishment, being able to do that with a minimal use of outside contractors.
Okay. Thank you.
A question from Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming that when it gets to the point that you're going to be doing the Class 3 work and the investment of $645 million, that's what you need, the project, the program receipt authority, in order to receive investments to allow that work to happen.
Through the chair, yes, that's true, but we also want the receipt authority for the broader construction work, that we've got to have somebody, an investor's got to see a clear sight through project completion.
Follow. Uh-huh. So the receipt authority will not be just for the total amount of spend that we're looking at on this page. Mm-hmm. It'll be for more than that.
Through the chair, correct. We want the receipt authority to be able to complete the project.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I think we're at page 7.
Okay. Now we'll like to go into the little more detail on the project cost, the capital cost, and then the economics of the project. But first, we put this slide in, slide 8, which really just emphasizes that the pipeline on this project is bigger than the LNG plant by about 500 million cubic feet. That capacity is reserved for Alaskan in-state needs. It's a little more than twice the current use of all of Alaska. So just to allay any fear that all of this is going to the LNG plant and all of that is going to be exported. We're looking at a gas pricing that's pretty economical within the state in the mid-single digits. I've said probably more than 5, but less than $6 per million BTU. We looked at some energy savings in the broader Mat-Su region and looking at about $1,000 per household. That can be more in an area like Fairbanks where they're burning oil. And then we have currently ongoing discussions with the in-state utilities.
Okay.
One bullet Parrish. I didn't maybe I missed over is small-scale LNG distribution. One of the things that we're looking at or able to look at and intend to pursue is the small-scale distribution of LNG within Alaska to the more remote communities, particularly coastal communities. So that'll come a little bit in the future.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have here, and through the chair, you have here $1,000 of energy savings on average per household. Is that per Alaskan household or per rail belt household?
It's really per rail belt, but with an emphasis on the Mat-Su area. It would be more than that if we looked at Fairbanks. So Fairbanks that burns oil today would see a more significant reduction.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The follow-up would be, has there been any conversation about something like a power cost equalization fund? I know when we put major investments into the past for energy costs, and particularly in the rail belt region, we put a similar amount of money in the power cost equalization fund in order to support our rural communities. Has there been any discussion about that?
I don't want to say there hasn't, but I know there's an allocation for the in-state markets. And Frank, you've got some details on that.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish. Again, when the legislature created AGDC, the issue was, again, it was working on an in-state pipeline project that would essentially benefit Fairbanks and South Central Alaska. And so the legislators from the rural communities wanted to make sure that Alaskans outside that corridor would be able to see the benefit of this. So I believe it was in Senate Bill 138 that they created a rural energy fund. I'm not sure the appropriate terminology, but I think it was 20% of the revenues that came in from the project was then going to be made available to the rural communities for energy.
And that last comment was from Vice President Richards. Representative Parrish.
The last follow-up would be, would you please in future presentations make clear the difference between per Alaskan household and per Matsu and Fairbanks household?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. And if I may, through the chair, one little clarification on Frank's comments on the 20% revenue. That's revenue received by the state, I believe, as opposed to total revenue for the project.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the bullet point about the small-scale LNG distribution, are you thinking of like a refined product or something? I think that's mostly what we've talked about, and just if there's something different.
Through the co-chair, yes. It would be LNG. So LNG in a tank, now you can put them in ISO tanks like a truck, you know, but with a cage around it for an ISO, like a container. They hold about 10,000 gallons. They're easily shipped. They can be shipped by barge. They can be moved by truck. The Alaskan Railroad has actually moved them as well, the first railroad in the country to move LNG as a cargo this way. So happy to see that. But it's a good way to get LNG. And then you just hook it up to a gas system, and then you warm it up a little bit, and it turns into natural gas. So it's become a great way for, like, oil field operators to get natural gas instead of diesel. They get it in by LNG, and you get that density of the volume, and then it's nice natural gas. Most of the heavy equipment makers, the high horsepower machine makers, the Caterpillar and that kind of thing, all offer gas conversion equipment. So you can take a diesel engine and convert it to natural gas. I heard some comment on the radio that, oh, you can't do that. It's actually a growth segment for the natural gas industry, is the conversion of diesel to natural gas through a rather simple conversion kit.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just looking at the slide with the $1,000 energy savings on average per household, how does that, I'm assuming that you're looking at statewide because some people are paying some very high energy prices, but how does that compare with gas that, for example, Anchorage gets from the Cook Inlet?
Well, we're really looking at, Lisa would like to address that. Go ahead.
I'd be happy to address that. This is Lisa Wilcox, AGDC. This is it's a broad calculation for current gas consuming households. So it's for current gas users. And as President Meyer mentioned before, we're looking at the mid single digit pricing. We compared that with the pricing of gas for Cook Inlet as we see it in the contracts that in some cases span through the mid 2020s. And we took the difference of the estimate and pricing that we know this project can deliver to current gas consumers and divided the total by the number of households. So it's a very broad calculation. It is for the current gas consumers. As Keith mentioned, the savings for households that don't have gas at the moment would have to take into account any additional infrastructure that it takes to deliver the gas there, including possibly shipping it as LNG or creating gas distribution systems, so it's a more complex calculation. But because their pricing is higher for energy, the savings could actually be higher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. President Meyer.
Okay. Let me go on then. So now we'll talk a little bit about the capital cost and the economics. I wanted to show the old versus the new structure. So the old structure on top, that was our consortium that we were involved in, the producer-led consortium. So I've got three columns there. One is capital contribution. We were expected to put in 25% of the capital. Capacity allocation, we were going to get 25% of the capacity. The ownership, we were going to have 25% of the ownership. Under our new structure with AGDC in the lead, We're looking at a 75% debt, 25% equity structure. That capital contribution would be 25%. The capacity allocation for the equity side is 25%, but our ownership now is still 100%. Now, we're going to be selling some of that ownership to raise our equity dollars, which is our $11 billion total equity number. But I wanted to highlight the difference between the structure, very similar old versus new, except for that ownership piece is significantly different because we own 100%. So now what I'd like to do, page 10, slide 10, is go through the costs, the capital cost of the project, because that's gotten a lot of attention. And so in developing the construction and capital cost estimate for the Alaska LNG system, over $600 million was spent in engineering, optimization, project management over a two-and-a-half-year period. So that was the producer-led, Exxon-led consortium number. The state was 25% of that. The resulting engineering, procurement, and construction cost estimate for the entire system under that study, $27.9 billion. So about $28 billion. To build the whole thing, gas treating plant, pipeline, LNG facility. Next page, owner's cost. So there were some costs that weren't in that construction cost, and those are owner's cost. So in addition to the construction cost, there are costs that the owners must bear. The largest of those was a project management team that would oversee the large contractors who were building the project. The cost of the project management team used in the Alaska LNG estimate is $3.4 billion. So that's $3.4 billion paid to a manager or a team to manage the large contractors. To put that in perspective, that's about $1 million a day for 9.5 years. So it's a big number. Additional owner's costs include feed. There's $764 million of feed. There's insurance, staffing up the operating organization that's going to operate the whole system, training them, starting up the system, and other stuff added up to about $2 billion for a total owner's cost of $6.2 billion. So my table at the right there has the construction cost of $27.9 billion to build the thing, $6.2 billion to manage it and oversee the construction. From there, it was recognized, well, wait a minute, you know, during construction, lots of things could go not according to plan. And so to estimate the downside exposure of all of these risks, the major cost components were subject to a probabilistic simulation where each of the big expense items were put into a simulation to say, well, what could go wrong? That produced this tornado diagram at the right. We've knocked off or disguised the individual items because it is confidential information, but the quantity is there. The total of all those things, if everything went wrong, was $7.7 billion, okay, if you add all those things together. Well, now, if everything is going wrong, there was an additional thought that that project management team that was getting $3.4 billion must need more funding. So an additional $1.6 billion was added to owner's costs for a total contingency of $9.3 billion. So if we go to the next page, 13, that adds up altogether to the number we're all more familiar with, which is the $43 billion number. So I just want to highlight, because we, you know, there's questions about, well, what could go wrong. There's a lot of stuff that is potential to go wrong that's already included in this number. So we got a construction of about $28 billion, owner's cost of $6 billion, gets us to about $34 billion. We've got contingencies of $9.3 billion. That's more than the gas treating plant. That's more than the pipeline. To get to a total of $43.4 billion. That's why I say we've got a total number of $43.4 that I consider to be reasonably comfortable in terms of fitting this project in. So all of our numbers are based on $43.4.
President Meyer, I think I've got a question for you this time, and I anticipate that others may have a similar question. When SB 138 passed in 2014, if I'm right, the number that was bandied about, or I suppose the target, was $45 to $60 billion. And had the original framework been pursued, would these other contingencies still have been delineated in this way? In other words, I assume that the contingencies and project management team components that you're discussing would have been there under either framework, that this is how these things get built.
Through the chair, yes, and these are the numbers developed by the team, by the former team. So we're taking these numbers. The number of 45 to 65, I think, was an early range before $600 million was spent. So it has not been much above 40 for a couple of years. But this is the approach used. It's a reasonable approach. I'm not saying it's not. It's just got a lot of, you know, robustness to it, let's call it, in terms of the contingencies and the project management of the project.
And just I'll follow up on my own question, and I guess what I'm just trying to clarify is that some may say that, for example, that sort of contingency seems ambiguous or sort of random. I suspect it doesn't or isn't, but the point I'm trying to make is that under the earlier framework where there was sort of the equal 25 participation by all participants, we would have seen this sort of component as well. Is that
correct?
Okay.
Correct. Yes.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, through the chair, thank you. I was just wondering, you came up with a number for the cost of everything going wrong. Could you just give us a couple examples of what you included to arrive at that number?
Through the chair, we could. So let me back up if I could. And where you're at a disadvantage is we don't have the category names. But for instance, missing the sea lift up at the north. You know, there's an eye of a needle we have to thread between whales and ice. So this assumes we miss that and we're delayed a year. Line pipe, you know, not being delivered on time. Lots of things that could go wrong. A strike by labor, that type of thing. So it's all of those things added together. Under the $7.7 billion, that sort of assumes everything goes wrong, so nothing goes in our favor, everything goes wrong, and it all sort of happens together.
Follow-up?
No, I'm good, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Tuck, didn't see. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just kind of going back over the slides, I don't mean to back up a little bit, but the cost of the project management team, $3.4 billion. And then the additional cost, which we consider the owner's cost, and we're looking at the project management team being separate from the owner's cost, right, or is it included?
No, that's a subset of, so it's part of owner's cost.
Part of owner's cost,
right.
Okay. And then, so we totaled that up, and so how does that compare? We're looking at $6.2 billion on a construction cost of $27.9 billion.
Correct. So if I may,
I'm just looking at the percentages and just wondering, is that standard? The percentages of what we were going to see for the total owner's cost, which includes insurance, includes the training and everything up, startup, is that pretty typical?
Well, I may look over it, Frank. I've got a word on that, but do you want to weigh in being much closer to that number?
Through the chair, Representative Truck, again, this owner's cost, it's nearly 25% of the base cost that is inclusive. If you look at a corollary with the state funds, primarily on DOT projects, you know, that within DOT, when they develop projects and they have construction-related oversight, the ranges are 16 to 22%. I'll call it a range. So this is, at this stage of the project, in that same range in terms of the overall cost. What's different, though, is it includes things that DOT wouldn't include in their owner's cost, such as the training or insurance, the front-end engineering and design. So there are factors in here that are different than, say, a regular DOT project. But, again, you're going to have you need to make sure that the owner
is represented to make sure that the project is being developed to meet the overall goals and the lowest cost of the project. So there's always going to be an owner's contingent within the project.
And then if I may, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative.
So we can easily say this is just more of that cushion that we're putting in there for the overall cost, is making sure that we can safely be able to meet these numbers.
Yes, I would say it's reasonable, not unreasonable, and it's I call it comfortable, but yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, on slide 14, then, potential reductions. So AGDC engaged Fluor to develop a zero-based estimate of the project and look at where we might have potential savings off the base, as well as adjusting the numbers for inflation. And we've identified a potential net $2 billion savings related to the optimization and strategic sourcing that could be had. We've also received some informal input, so not a formal offer, but informal input from a major contractor with the capability to manage the project, that they would perform the project management for significantly less than the $3.4 billion used in the estimate. Now, none of those reductions have been incorporated into our cost estimate. So we're sticking with what we have, which is the 43.4, and that's what we're basing our numbers on.
Okay. Continue.
Next, slide 15 just quickly looks at the debt and equity structure, capital structure here. So we're looking at like 75% debt, 25% equity. This is on the full project, so all these numbers are full project, 20 million tons, 42-inch pipeline, equity requirement of about $11 billion. And we'll come. I'll come back to that. And then we've got the O&M, the operations and maintenance, is about $1 billion by the time we get to our in-service time of 2024. And that's just split here by LNG, GTP, and pipeline for an O&M number. So I'm going to show how that comes into play.
Representative Johnson.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. If we may go back to page 14.
Yes.
Slide 14. Where you say that AGDC has received informal input from a major contract, they would perform the project management for significantly less. What is that number?
We don't have a formal number. It's just they sort of indicated that number they felt was more than comfortable. Doesn't mean it's a bad number or unreasonable. They just would do it for less than that.
I'm just trying to figure out why that's in here.
Why what's in here?
Why this paragraph is in here. So
because I think we could get project management for less than $3.4 billion. So the $3.4 billion was being paid to a large project management team that was going to be stood up, you know, by the producers. I think we've got contractors that are in the game of construction management that do that as a course of business that would do the work for potentially less. Not half, but you know, I'll throw out a number of 75%, let's say. But right. But that does not mean the 3.4 is unreasonable. So I want to say that it's not an unreasonable number. It was put together with a lot of thought and big companies putting it together, and they do fine work, I'm sure. But it's just, you know, it's maybe not their core business to manage construction projects.
Okay. So we were on Representative Tarr.
On slide 16. And this is a point that was made in an earlier meeting, and something I think it is important for us to remember that, you know, some of the spending here that's listed, you know, you're putting it in the context of its functionality, but this would be largely, and I didn't see it on the slide, dollars that would stay in state and, you know, provide jobs for Alaskans. And I just thought you might want to touch on that point of it for a moment.
Okay, yeah, Co-Chair Tarr, I appreciate that. Yes. Basically, all of the O&M will stay in state. So this is all, you know, Alaskan labor, contractors, you know, up and down the line, North Slope, you know, Nikiski, and in between. So this all stays within the state.
Yes, Representative Parrish, we're on page 16. Questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, what are the contractual or legal commitments to doing so, and how do you plan to get around the... You know, freedom of someone to go work wherever they want in the United States.
Through the chair, we're you know, it's sort of come on, work on the pipeline. You don't have to, you're not going to be chained to it. But at the same time, this O&M number, so this is the life of the project. This is not construction. This is the operating life, so it's, you know, it's people that live in the communities that would come here and work for the project. And what I've said is, you can take an Alaskan kid in high school today, gets out of high school, goes either to college or a trade school. He can work on this project, he or she can work on this project their entire working life and have their child work on this project their entire working life. This has, you know, this is a multi-generational service, right? It's a pipeline system that liberates one of the world's great resource bases up in the North Slope. It's going to be around for generations. So I expect this to be an attractive place to work and a very good career choice.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That still doesn't answer my question. How will it be fundamentally different from other jobs in the resource extraction industry where we can see a really significant percentage, ballpark of 30% of workers being, you know, basically from down south coming up to work their 2 weeks and then fly back to their home for the balance? How are you going to avoid that?
Through the chair, I don't know exactly which projects or resources you're talking about. We can't, you know, make them stay. But one thing with the pipeline and the LNG facility, I would say it's more normal day kind of work. Now the GTP up at the north may be different, where you have crews that are on, you know, for 2 weeks and off for 2 weeks. Just because of the remoteness. But with respect to the LNG plant, that's going to be, you know, in Nikiski, we're going to have multiple shifts, but it's not like you'd have it's not like an offshore facility or a remote facility. You're going to drive to work, you're going to drive home, you're going to pretty much, it wouldn't make sense, I wouldn't think, to fly in and out there. Similar for the pipeline. Most of the pipeline control center is going to be south, you know, not up at the north. So same thing, it's going to be drive to work, drive home, not fly in and out. But the GTP, which is up at the north, I recognize that labor component up there is used to a more of a 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and we may find that with this as well.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just kind of want to address that question just a little bit. You know, one of the best ways to make sure that Alaskans get to those jobs first is a project labor agreement. Because I know with the book systems, with the construction labor unions, typically is book one is Alaska resident, certified to do the work, pass an apprenticeship training class. And then book two is the high school training that perhaps are not Alaska residents. And then book three is Alaska residents who have not quite had all the full training. And then when you look at the apprenticeship programs usually require a one-year residency before going through that, and so you're making sure the Alaskans are trained first. So one of the ways that we can enforce that is making sure we have project labor agreement on the contracts.
And through the chair, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you, Mark, for that point. That to me also highlights, you know, right now we can start training people. You know, there's no reason why not, you know, put people through the pipeline center up at Fairbanks, you know, get them trained on the different jobs that are going to be needed. There's no job on this pipeline or LNG plant that can't be learned by an Alaskan living here today. It's not like it's a, you know, rocket science kind of a thing. It's a solid industry. It's a mature industry in this country. It's trainable, and there's no reason why not to start training now. So and I agree, that's probably the best way to assure that people and that Alaskans stay here and work on the project is let's get ready and get trained and be on board. Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Yeah, and Mr. Kocher, I just thought I would mention that the governor did mention a project labor agreement in his State of the State speech as a component of this project. So I thought that was good that he, you know, made that public comment that indicates he's wanting jobs for Alaskans.
Co-Chair Tarr, correct. He did, and we are going to have one. I presented to the AFL-CIO. I think that was the first question. You know, before I could take a breath, there was a hand up. Are you going to have a project labor agreement? We said, yes, we are.
Okay. All right, page 17.
Okay, 17, this now starts to look at how are you going to, so we've got $43 billion. What does it look like over time? This is the construction draw schedule. So this is how we spend the money in the construction phase. It's separated there by the major component, GTP, pipeline, LNG, as well as the owner's cost and the contingency. The red line there looks to the right-hand side of the graph. That's the cumulative without the contingency, and then the black line above it is with the contingency. So that sort of sets up the time when funds are needed. Just my bullets here. So this looks at construction commencing in the back half of 2019, which is our current schedule. We want to put train 1 in service by third quarter of 24, train 2 by third quarter 25, train 3 by third quarter 26. So that's sort of been the construction plan, and that's what we're sticking to. Next page looks at the debt side of that. So it takes that project draw and then puts some assumptions on it. So the cost of service in the system is highly influenced by the cost and the term of debt. Right now we're looking at a debt term of about 20 years, a 5% interest rate. Under that assumption, we've got an annual debt service of about $3.5 billion a year. So we've got the drawdown in the front, that negative number, and then we've got a payment of about $3.5 billion as an operating expense throughout the life of the loan. Last bullet there, in the debt for capacity proposal, which we're going to talk about, which is sort of our Sinopec deal, the customer actually helps secure the debt, and the cost and the term of the debt is passed through to the customer. Equity side, so that's our $11 billion, assuming the full project is built all at once. That's page 19. The owners will receive a return on the investment through the sale of system capacity after paying the debt service and O&M expenses. So the system sells capacity. We've got to pay the O&M. We've got to pay debt service. We're living off of the excess capacity, if you will, which is our 25% in this example. The return on investment will be dependent primarily on the price of the LNG sold and the cost of the debt. Fourth bullet, the $11 billion equity requirement will be 25% of the total equity. Under the current assumptions, the return on equity is about 8% for the initial term, 10% for the project life, 15% if the state is the investor, because the state receives other revenue associated with royalty and that type of thing.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said if the state is the investor, what level of investment does that envision?
This is if the state was the entire investor for the $11 billion.
Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the debt for capacity, the cost and term is passed through to the consumer. What happens when that, after paying off the debt service to consumer costs?
So when at the end of the term of the debt, the contract expires, all of the capacity comes back to the owners.
Okay, so that doesn't necessarily pass through to the consumers.
The cost of the capacity? Or
yeah, so after the debt service is paid off, will that reduce consumer costs? Will that get passed on to the consumer? Is really my question.
So through the chair, when the debt gets paid off, all of a sudden the capacity all comes back to us, so now we can sell that capacity again, but now the system's already paid for. And so there's a significant uplift in revenue received and income retained once the debt is paid off.
And if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
So the debt service really is the obligation to move the gas.
Through the chair, if I may, under the Sinopec arrangement or the debt for capacity arrangement, the payment of capacity is the payment of the debt. So we pay the debt through capacity itself or through LNG.
The movement of the, okay, All right. Thank you.
The movement, or maybe more specifically, the right to move. So okay. We're not necessarily requiring the customer has to lift cargoes, has to take LNG, but they have to pay. They've already paid for the system. They have the right to use it. So it'll be like a pipeline company.
Okay. That makes sense to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. If the worst happens and renewable energy really takes off, cheap, abundant energy globally, and the price of oil crashes to $27 a barrel and looks like it's going to stay there for the long term, what happens to us on our debt?
Okay, through the chair. So this is probably going to is worthy of a longer discussion, but let me say this. The probability of hydrocarbon usage, you know, going away completely in our lifetime and children's is probably low. The probability that the world embraces a cleaner hydrocarbon molecule, which is the methane molecule, CH4 is the most simplest hydrocarbon molecule on the planet, that's very high. So we're going to start to see heavier molecules, coal, heavy oil, that type of thing, be in less demand in favor of that lighter molecule, methane. And we see that in a big way in China, which currently buys half the world's coal. They're shifting to natural gas. So we see gas demand going up over time relative to other hydrocarbons, not to take anything away from wind and solar, but it's not always sun shining and the wind isn't always blowing, but you're going to have battery technology and all that kind of stuff. So places like Kodiak, for instance, beautiful example of where wind works, you know, great. Their oil use is down to a fraction. We don't see that in a big way here. We see natural gas being in demand for a long, long time. We think, though, that Alaska is very well positioned in the largest LNG market on the planet, which is Asia. And we see that use of methane increasing in Asia because there's still a lot of heavy oil, a lot of coal burning. Then you also have large oil-consuming industries like the marine industry, the heavy marines. They're all shifting to natural gas. So we see gas demand for fuel, for high horsepower engines, and for home heating needs and for electric generation needs going up. So what happens to us? I think the gas demand is always there. During the debt period of time under our debt for capacity, they have the right to take it. I expect them to take it. If they don't take it, okay. They've already paid for the system. They're going to pay 75% of O&M. After the system's all paid for, we have a pipeline that links the north to the world markets. I'm a believer in methane. I say we've got a multi-generational asset that's going to continue to encourage drilling for natural gas up at the north. And we're going to have an Asian market that welcomes the methane molecule.
Follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly hope you're right about the long-term demand, but we really got ourselves into a jackpot once as a state by not adequately anticipating the potential downturn and price of one of our main commodities. Actually, it's happened twice, hasn't it? I guess the question remains: if the price of LNG, for whatever reason, takes a significant hit, how exposed are we as a state?
Through the chair, I would say very little. And part of the reason I say that, if you look at the oil side, which you've mentioned, I think the revenue and the return on the pipeline has been pretty steady. But you don't own the pipeline. Here we own the pipeline. So what we are, we're an infrastructure company. So we're building a pipeline. We're building a logistics facility, which is LNG, that takes gas, turns it to liquid so it can be shipped economically on a boat. That's what people are buying. They're paying, you know, for our system. That's going to be a very stable price. So we're really insulated from commodity price fluctuation. That's the reason we're attractive to pension funds, insurance companies, and other risk-averse investors. But it's also why we're not going to be a stratospheric return when energy prices are way high, because we don't have that commodity exposure. Now, the gas side, may fluctuate if it's priced that way. Now, I will tell you, though, the customers that we're selling natural gas to are utilities. Okay, they're either gas or electric utilities for the most part. They have millions of customers. They love this thought of stability. So just like in your utility bills, if you had a stable price that wasn't linked to some crazy oil price, you would probably be happier because you would be have more predictability. The utilities love this thought of stable pricing. Alaska actually has the ability to offer that because we've got a natural gas supply that is not linked to a volatile index price. Like the lower 48, all the gas is linked to something called Henry Hub. That's a volatile price. It's got a lot of volatility. It's just in the last few weeks, you know, with the cold spell there, it nearly doubled. That kind of uncertainty is not good for the ratepayers, but they have no choice. Now, most of the Asian LNG is linked to oil. So it's linked to an oil price, but that's not necessarily because the buyers want it that way now. It's just the way it's been sold. So I think we've got the ability certainly to stabilize the price of the infrastructure, but also if we wanted to stabilize that price of the commodity and really get insulated from that energy price volatility.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Tor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question on slide 18, and I just want to make sure I have the right number in my head. For the debt, what total number are you using for this slide for the debt?
The $32 billion.
Okay, so the difference between the 43 minus
correct.
The equity.
Right.
And then there was one other question I had. On the next slide here, I just want to make sure the bottom right, the annual construction spend equity capital. So what you're trying to do on that one is take that $11 billion and put it over a year-by-year spend?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Through the chair, yes, correct. And so that lines up with the debt drawdown, which lines up with that total construction spend.
And just one other. On the slide 18, pardon me, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the previous slide, the 20-year term, I was just trying to remember, the initial contracts for service are also going to be 20 years, so those are all aligned in terms of the timelines.
Correct. They, through the chair, yes, correct, they are. We have indicated that we would be willing to go up to 30 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We're on page 20, and we need about a three-hour meeting at this point, so we should try to...
Okay. I'm going to go quick through these, if I may. So this is balancing three drivers, so we have to balance three things. We've got to balance the market price, that's customers. We've got to balance the financial markets. We've got to operate the system in the middle, but then we've got to have something acceptable to the resource owner, which is the state of Alaska. So that's the netback price. So I want to walk through these really quickly, if I could, and give you a sense of how we're getting to the prices we're at. For the market price, we're using a proxy of about $8. We get there because one of our big competition is Texas, Louisiana. That's at a Henry Hub price, which is about $3.50, plus $5. The $5 is liquefaction, so it's got to be liquefied. It's fuel for liquefaction. It's shipping. They're three times the distance compared to us. And it's the Panama Canal. So you add that all together, it's about $5. So within the industry, if you can beat Henry Hub plus $5, you're in the hunt in Asia. Now, that's an Asian price. To get to Asia, we need about 80 cents shipping. So if I take $8 in Asia and on the beach of China, deduct shipping, 80 cents, I get about 720 at the beach in Nikiski. So that's the number we've got to see. Can we meet that with this system? Are we economic? So we look at the components. We've got a system O&M that we talked about. We've got a PILT in there. You add that all together, it's about $1.4 billion that we want. That translates to about $1.45 per unit per million BTU. The financing, we got our $3.5 billion debt service we talked about. That's about $3.60 a unit. Equity, we got about $1.1 billion a year return. That's about $1.15. You add that all together, For our system, our infrastructure system, we need about $6.20 per million BTU to take gas from the north, liquefy it, put it on a boat in the Kiski. Next slide, then. If we take that all together, we take our $8 less 80 cents, 720 at the beach in the Kiski, subtract our 620, we end up with about a dollar net back to the north for the gas supply. The gas quantity that we're talking about is roughly 1 trillion cubic feet per year. So that's about $1 billion per year in gas supply for the north. And you put it all together, and it looks like this on slide 25. So we got the $8 over there on the left-hand side. We've got the dollar, $1.45, $4.75 for finance. That balances with our 720. Everybody on the left-hand side would like to pay less. Everybody on the right-hand side would like to get more. But we've got to sort of balance everybody in between, and we think we've got a nice balance here where everybody can be satisfied. Next one, this looks at the investment profile, and it really looks at if Alaska was the sole investor for the $11 billion. So during, and there's three big phases there. The first one is the construction phase, so that's, you know, now through 2025, let's call it. So we've got a significant employment boom going on there. Everybody's, you know, happy. Hotels are full. Taxi cabs are busy. Then we go into the operating phase while we're also paying the debt. So that's that $1.1 billion a year. There's an inflation escalator on there. But the state also gets, we're also taking credit in here for the PILT that gets put into the communities, the O&M, then there's royalty, and then taxes gas. That's why the state, as the investor, gets a slightly higher return perspective than the non-state investor, because there's these other income items. Once the debt is paid off, then that income jumps way up and to a number of about $6 billion, which I've said you can easily sell for like at least a 10 times multiple if somebody wanted to, and monetize the whole system for a $50 to $60 billion number once that debt is paid off. Next page just drills down a little bit on the state perspective. That's slide 27. So that says, well, what if the state doesn't invest anything at all? So none of the $11 billion comes from the state. We get it all from outside. It's still a great deal. The state gets about $250 to $500 million for the gas supply. $250 is at the dollar price. We could get more. The PILT, $450 to $500 million. O&M, $950 million. So it's about $1.5 to $2 billion number that comes into the state economy, even if the state was not an investor. Okay, now what I wanted to do quickly. Yes, sir.
Just to clarify, you said to the state's economy, or did you mean to the state's, for the state of Alaska as far as revenue? Or are you just talking about total economic gain?
Correct. Not so much revenue, but into the state's economy. So the $1 billion of O&M, that's Alaskan labor, contractors, all that. The PILT, you know, gets distributed. The gas resources is revenue from, you know, to the state from the sale of gas. But the rest of it is just into the economy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Parrish.
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Oh, I was asked. Think Representative Tuck got to my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, if we could, I wanted to just touch on the Sinopec deal, and then we're going to turn it over to Ms. Wilcox. The joint development agreement is what we signed in front of President Trump, President Xi. It's flanked there by lots of support in Washington on the left-hand side, lots of support in China on the right-hand side. We say large deal for a large project. So what we propose to them, we sort of were thinking outside the box a bit, recognizing our position where we are in the globe, and recognizing where Asia is, particularly China and Japan, Korea. So we made a proposal to the top LNG consuming nations, the Asian governments, to you give us money for the debt, we're going to pay you back in capacity. And so the that was the proposal made. We would take the 25% equity piece and fund that ourselves for 25% of the capacity. but we retain 100% of the ownership. And then plus there's this 500 a day available for the Alaskans. Well, the last bullet is just partial ownership investment by third parties as a potential, but AGDC will remain in control.
And I just want to understand, when you say in-country bank provides the debt for 75% of the capital cost, so is that in a lump sum kind of payment, or if it aligns where the proposal that, you know, looks very positive here, that the, you know, the customer is also involved in that relationship, then, you know, could it be that they do that as an annual payment because we have a commercial relationship with them?
Through the chair, it's not necessarily all up front, but it's in line with the construction draw
schedule. Oh, that's
so it's all in the construction period.
Okay.
But it could be over that draw schedule.
Got it. Thank you.
And then page 30 is just a diagram of this that maybe makes it a little bit easier to explain. So what we're looking at, we've got a buyer, we've got a lender. Those two are related. What we've said is, okay, the lender loans us 75% of the capital cost, like a loan, like we were going to get anyway. But we're going to pay back that loan by giving capacity to a buyer, and the buyer is going to make the debt service payments to the lender. And therefore, the term and the pricing of that is somewhat insulated from us, and even the currency. And so our obligation is to provide the capacity, buyer pays the lender, and that happens for the term of the loan. Buyer also has to pay 75% of the O&M for the life and has to buy the gas supply. So what this does then is now turn our focus over to the equity side, where we look at the equity funds, so that's the $11 billion, 25%, and we would get 25% of the capacity for sale into regional markets. Another diagram just on this. So it sort of looks like this. We expect 75% to go to China and be distributed by Sinopec, not all to Sinopec, but they would be the single in-country buyer, and they would distribute it. And then we've got the regional markets, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, others, where we would monetize that 25%. And so here's that pie chart again, a 75-25. So again, the $11 billion equity requirement to be raised by AGDC, this really turns our focus to the equity funding. So we've got a year of papering with Sinopec, Bank of China, other banks on the red side, the debt for capacity side. But we've also got these customer discussions going on in Japan, Korea, and others for our equity portion. So the equity investment, the equity owners of Alaska LNG will invest up to $11 billion. We would earn a return on that investment through the sale of our 5 million tons of system capacity not dedicated to the debt service or debt for capacity customers. That is also allocated 25% of the O&M. The return is dependent in part on the price of the LNG sold. So we may be able to sell into shorter-term, higher-valued markets and increase that return.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meyer, do you mean then like a spot market sales? Is that
it could be, or shorter-term, you know, five-year term, three-year term.
Okay.
But some, through the chair, yes, could be allocated to spot market.
Mm-hmm.
And spot market has a high degree of volatility. So it's high right now. In the summer, it was pretty low, so and that's to be expected. Asia is largely a winter purchase market, so it gets pretty tight in the winter.
Right.
China got very, very tight. You know, they've had a big push on gas.
Mm-hmm.
They even had to have ISO containers of LNG sent from Canada to China just to help relieve their gas shortage.
Okay.
So the return on equity, this is a lot of words on here, but the bottom line is that at our current pricing, we're looking at about an 8% kind of rate of return on 100% equity basis, but we do have the ability to lever that as well. So we've got the ability to issue bonds. If we do a long-term contract, that could justify some bank debt. So we could increase that return through just simple leveraging. I have one more picture, and that's this one. And this is our structure that we talked about, so this may address the earlier question. This is how we're looking at structuring. So that big blue box, that would be the Alaska LNG project entity. Up above that, we've got the equity in green. So that would be third parties, which could be financial investors, that kind of thing. State of Alaska right in the middle that I have it straddling between required and optional. And, again, I'd like to have this structure such that the state has the option to invest, not the requirement. And then on the right-hand side, purely optional, are the Alaskans, municipalities, native corporations. And so that's how we're envisioning the structure being held. It's pretty traditional, pretty standard. And that's where we need that receipt authority, the program receipt.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this slide, it may not be the right place, but I'm just wondering. I know, for example, maybe a year, even more now ago, AGDC formed a subsidiary, and I think that was to look at maybe marketing, or there were some specific sort of responsibilities for what that sub might do. And I'm just trying to think, in this structure here, because you have the ability to form subsidiaries, where you have State of Alaska, would that be where we might see some subsidiaries form that would, you know, be involved in specific pieces of the overall project?
Yes, through the chair, yes, that could be. So State of Alaska could be AGDC as well. It could be subsidiaries. Now, there's a nonprofit subsidiary also set up for in-state sales. So part of SB 138, we don't profit off sales to in-state. So that's what that was for. This Alaska LNG project company would be a for-profit entity that we would be a part owner of if we allowed third parties in.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. I was intrigued by your mention of ISO containers being shipped to China.
Yes.
This past winter, that they already need the gas, in other words.
Through the chair, yes, they do. So they've been on a very concerted effort to increase their gas use. So they've gone from virtually nothing 10 years ago. They've got 16 import terminals. They just surpassed Korea as the number two buyer in the world for LNG purchase, and they're on their way to surpass Japan in probably a couple years. But, yes.
Excellent. Thank you.
And Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to slide 30.
Yes.
When we look at the I'm just waiting for it to pop up. That's all. But when we look at the lender-buyer relationship, how much are we concerned about what happens on the left side of that?
Through the chair, so we're concerned on all these pieces. It has to be a fair and balanced deal. It has to clear many markets, so we've got to, you know, clear the financial markets as well. The lender most likely will not be one lender. It'll be a consortium of banks. But where we're trying to appease multiple parties is, you know, getting a purchase agreement that satisfies lending agreements, that satisfies us, that satisfies, you know, the equity owners, as well as the gas suppliers. So all of this stuff has to hang together. There can't be too much risk on either side. But right now we feel this arrangement is pretty well balanced in that China has lots of funds, lots of U.S. dollars. The United States has a very, very strong message that we want China to buy more stuff from the U.S. The two countries have agreed that LNG is one of those things that would be a good fit. So we've got a lot of support on the government side. This does have to go through a CFIUS procedure, so that's the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. That has to be approved by the federal government. So there's lots of boxes to check, lots of paperwork to do in 2018. We're not going to get taken advantage of. There was some fear that, oh, my gosh, the Chinese are going to out-negotiate us. They're not. I think we're pretty comfortable there. But it's going to, we're going to involve lots of lawyers, lots of bankers, lots of consultants. At the end of the day, if this works, we will have about $32 billion from China. We'll bury it in the ground in Alaska in the form of pipes and LNG facilities, and we'll be a long-term supplier for them that they can rely on for many years to come. And if we look at the Nikiski project, Conoco's project that provided LNG supply reliably to Japan for 40 years, longest running contract in the LNG industry. I expect us to do the same thing here. And I think as long as all parties are reasonable, like I said, this is a multi-generational project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, what would being out negotiated look like? What should we be wary of?
Well, we would through the chair. Out negotiated would look like an unbalanced deal that might have too much risk on the state side, which we're not going to take, might have, let's say, ownership, significant majority ownership that might come with it. So a lot of the fear was, oh my gosh, 75%, they're going to have 75% ownership. No, they're not. So that kind of a thing would be worthy of watching out for. And let me also just for the avoidance of doubt, this will be a very transparent deal, very high profile deal, not just in Alaska, but in the industry, across the waters. So there will be a lot of transparency and a lot of opportunities for scrutiny.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if I may, that ends my section. And now we're going to turn it over to Ms. Wilcox for the commercial side, if that's all right.
Yes. And I think we'll have Ms. Wilcox present her slides and hold questions until those six slides are done.
Okay. Wonderful. For the record, this is Lisa Wilcox, Vice President for Commercial and Economics for AGDC. I would like to start with just an update on the supply and demand forecast slide. I believe in the last hearing that I was in for the joint Senate and House resources, there were questions and requests to take a look at various sources of data for the forecast. So we did go back and do a review. It's always difficult to do these things apples to apples, but on slide 38, you do have an updated chart that shows the stack of long-term contracts for the four main consuming areas in Asia, groups of consumers, Japan, Korea, mainland China, and Taiwan, and those are your currently leading consumers in terms of long-term contracts. You can see in that stack that Japan, all of them actually have expiring contracts that start to come into play. And directionally, I would say Japan being a bit overbought at the moment in long-term contracts is reducing the number of long-term contracts in the future. But we're seeing the opposite from the likes of China, because they've traditionally bought spot because their industry has been growing and their demand has been growing. But now that they have 19 functioning LNG terminals, they have, I think, a total of 30 that's planned. That is existing, planned, or under construction. They're starting to think a lot more long-term, and they're looking for stability. Their LNG imports went up 46% this year, so kind of that's a November number, so compared to a year ago. So their gas demand is growing, and they're not keeping up domestically, even though they're also growing their natural gas production in country. So that's why you see a lot of lot of growth conversation focused on China, is because they are growing. They've had a track record of growth, and they have a forecast of growth from every single source in the industry. The only question is how much, how fast. And the reason is that they're still relying on natural gas for their energy, in just about between 7% and 8% for the entire energy mix. And coal is near 65%. So they're still very heavily coal-based and really focusing on the environmental impacts of that. One of the things when I presented at the World Trade Center presentation yesterday, I cited that President Xi, in his latest address in October to the leadership of his government, mentioned the word environment 89 times. So that's been a very strong drive from the government to to focus on natural gas. So on the forecast side, for demand, you can see a range, and we had, in addition with our internal forecast from the consultant that we've used, we put in a KPMG Global Energy Institute on IHS market numbers in there. So that's why you see a diverging range of forecasts going into the future for those four markets. It's just focusing on those four rather than entirety of Asia or the world demand. And you can see the entire three trains and how the three trains of Alaska LNG would fit into that picture simplistically. Any questions? Oh, we're holding questions. So next slide, 39. The market for LNG is growing more liquid, but as I mentioned, long-term contracts are still seen as beneficial to buyers and sellers. Projects need long-term contracts in order to finance themselves, and buyers are looking at stability for long-term contracts and stability in pricing and different pricing structures other than oil-linked or possibly Henry Hub-linked are being considered by many projects. And Alaska has a very good ability to provide that. So buyers will look at how their portfolios are structured, and they will probably try to have a mix of long-term and short-term, a mix of oil-linked, Henry Hub-linked, and other pricing structures in their portfolios. And those, of course, who are project developers and have a portfolios will do the same. But in general, you know, buyers will look at a piece of their portfolio coming from a single project, you know, not to exceed a certain percentage. And every one of them has a different sensitivity, but they're never going to, almost never going to buy 100% from one supplier. So that's why we have the opportunity to fit into several buyers' portfolios, not just, you know, not just Sinopec and not entirely China. On the next slide, on 40, this is why in the previous year we've spent the year very busily canvassing, building market awareness, and building relationship with potential buyers. We know we need more than one for this project, and we're focused strategically on the markets that are closest to us, but also the markets where we know growth potential is really strong and are also forging a strategic relationship with the United States. One of those countries is China. Another country, for example, is Vietnam. That's where we took a G2G approach, and the MOU that was signed with Petro Vietnam Gas was also done in the presence of the two presidents of the countries, U.S. and China, because it is very important for Vietnam to show the trade connection to the United States. And it's also very important for them as a state-owned company, Petro Vietnam Gas, to have the support of their government. So in some cases, this G2G approach was very successful. In others, we dealt directly with buyers, and that's where those 11 to 12, you know, LOIs were signed. In some cases, they were announced. In some cases, they were not, as is more the industry practice. The ones that were announced were KOGAS, Tokyo Gas, Petro Vietnam Gas, and, of course, the joint development agreement with Sinopec, and we continue to work on all of those and progressing the agreements to the next stage. So on the next slide, on 41, what that means for our 2018 is that we will busily be working to turn the relationships that we've built and turn these agreements that we've signed into definitive agreements. So that's a lot more legal work, commercial work, finance, and we'll continue to build and train our team in Anchorage, I would say. In the past, when we've been here, we've mentioned that we have industry expert support. Some of it is located in Houston, but one of the great things that has happened this year is a lot of that knowledge has transferred into AGDC, into Anchorage as well. So a lot more of our activities are getting done out of Anchorage, out of the Anchorage group. And our plan is to conclude the agreements that are envisioned in the joint development agreement with Sinopec, Bank of China, CIC, but also not lose track of the other agreements that we've made on the equity side of LNG marketing and have enough sale and purchase agreements for the LNG built up in order to enable project sanctioning in 2019 and project financing in 2019. That really concludes my update, and we look forward to a very busy year and continued reports on progress as it is made on these agreements.
So let me start with a question, Ms. Wilcox. In today's piece by Mr. DeMarbini, talks about he quotes you and notes that you reported that the Bank of China is working to bring together a team of banks to finance $32 billion in the project, and we're arranging for that. And that was delightful to read. I'm a supporter of what you're doing. But can you give us a little bit more sense, because I think the reader would look at that and be left with the feeling that things are well in order and that this may very well come to pass in the short term. Is there something you want to add?
Representative Josephson, thank you for that question. The direct quote, I believe, actually came from Bank of China. I was there in the interview, but it came from the Bank of China representative. And the comment that he made was related to the fact that it is a large project, mm-hmm. and the Bank of China will be looking to bring in other banks in order to support the investment. So they would, you know, for the debt for capacity portion of it, they would be the lead in China because they've taken on that role, mm-hmm. and they will bring in others. So that means there are also detailed agreements associated with the arrangement of the debt for Bank of China itself. But that type of arrangement is created for all major projects. It's rarely just one bank that finances a project, even smaller LNG projects. Bank of China has financed a number of LNG projects, projects in the world, and they've usually taken a part of that financing.
And to clarify, I've got the attribution wrong. It was Mr. Chow of the New York mm-hmm. branch of Bank of China. But I, just to follow up, what do you see, starting with November 9th and the mm-hmm. events on that day, what does this say to you about progress since November 9th and what happened yesterday's meeting?
Yeah. Well, Representative Josephson, I was actually myself, you know, we knew we were presenting at the World Trade Center. We knew the Bank of China was coming. I was actually myself pleasantly surprised in the level of support that the project got and the level of support that that the project got from both the consulate in San Francisco and the Bank of China. I think it was wonderful that they came up. They came up for this event that the World Trade Center organized. We were not the organizer of the event. We were a sponsor, and we were very happy to participate and speak. And it was not around a meeting that was scheduled with the Bank of China. So they came up specifically to make themselves known as a participant, an active participant of the project and a supporter of the project. So I thought that was honestly quite good. and we are engaged separately, but it is a very very large company, so to have the representative from New York come up just to speak at this was really nice.
Great. Any questions on the 6 slides presented by Ms. Wilcox? Mm-hmm. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I failed to ask this before, I do feel remiss. I think I did, though. You've got the contracted amounts in the LNG supply-demand forecast, mm-hmm. But that isn't really the supply. That's the contracts. That's the agreements. It doesn't get to capacity. It doesn't get to how many people are entering the natural gas market who are going to be our competition. And I'd find it very useful to know over the next 10 years how many new entrants we're expecting and how much capacity we we think that they're going to bring online. Additionally, going out to bid at a time when a bunch of contracts are being renewed and presumably renegotiated is going to be intense. I certainly wish you every success, and you know, though I remain somewhat skeptical, your presentation thus far does seem to answer some of my concerns. But I would like to see what the overall supply gas coming out of the ground picture looks like.
Okay, Representative Parrish, through the chair, recognize your request, and we can provide that data. The number of suppliers that are coming into the market is always somewhat fungible, particularly for new developments. There is definitely a picture that shows, well, if all existing contracts were renewed and if taken into account basin depletion and local demand for that gas, you know, and a lot of other factors, there's forecasts out there that still show a gap in supply demand. That gap is not nearly as large because this is just showing long-term contracts. So that is absolutely correct. The number of entrants coming into the market is always somewhat fungible because it depends on the funding for those entrants, their own investment decision, the progress of the project and the commitment of the project and the pricing that they're willing to offer and strike a deal at. So to an extent, the projects that stay in the game, by definition, have a higher chance of success to be in that mix.
A quick follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could provide some estimate, I think you're very smart people and probably probably have a pretty good sense if you look around of how much is likely to come on. I would like to ask at some point what the bill is going to be to take down the project at the end of its service life, and you can use pre-inflation dollars to do that.
President Meyer.
Through the chair, if I may, I'll take that number only because I know we don't have that exact number. However, I will say for an LNG plant, and you could probably look at Nikiski as an example, not much wear and tear on the LNG parts of that, so you can probably find a contractor to take the scrap value of the plant and clean the site for the LNG plant. You know, it's a pretty clean operation. Pipelines, gas pipelines, are typically inerted and left underground because they're buried. They're not above ground. So typically you fill them with nitrogen, and then you just leave them in place once the system's truly never going to be utilized. I would make an argument, though, that the North Slope, if we're even a quarter right, that's got enough reserves for many decades. So it's going to be a long time. I'm more familiar with pipelines that get expanded over time. Like if you look at the lower 48, you start with one, you eventually loop that, you eventually loop it again, as long as the gas supply is there. So is that a sufficient dodge of that question?
It is a beautiful dodge. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. A quick question from Representative Johnson, and we're going to proceed on to page 43 and close out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask the question that, again, I probably asked before, and multiple people have probably asked before, but we have zero binding agreements. I'm not sure which page that was on. Tell us an update on what you see as the timeline for a binding agreement.
Why don't I take that since I've got the microphone? Really, we're looking at 2018 as being the year that we really focus on definitive agreements, particularly for the Chinese contracts. And then we're looking at having really all of our commercial agreements done within the first half of 2019 so that we can take a final investment decision in the front half of 2019 in order to begin construction in the back half of 2019. In order to take a final investment decision, we need binding commercial agreements, binding loan documents, equity investors. We have to get through the regulatory arena, which is going to take this year as well. So it's all of that paperwork that's got to come together. But each one of these purchase agreements is a multi-billion dollar international purchase transaction that underpins a very significant financing. So it takes time. I mean, we're actually working on a pretty aggressive schedule. So this year, end of this year, we're looking at really bringing those all to conclusion for a finalization by the front part of 2019.
Okay. So,
I'll turn it over to Mr. Richards.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Frank Richards. I would like to provide at least a brief overview of the regulatory and technical highlights since we last spoke. I believe it was October-November timeframe. So on slide 44, this represents the Alaska LNG regulatory timeline. Again, as I said earlier, we had applied to FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, in April. They accepted that application, but then provided us with a data request for 801 additional responses. We did have, though, an application to what is called the Steering Committee for FAST 41 approval, which would essentially gets recognition at the federal level for this project because it meets the criteria at the within the law that says this project is a energy-related project that is of high enough stature to be represented on a dashboard at the federal level, and it really puts emphasis on the federal agencies, the regulatory agencies, to identify their schedule for providing permits, with the caveat that if they don't meet their schedule, then they have to report back to Congress, and as you guys do, when the legislature, Congress provides them appropriations, so it's not a good thing to have a black mark on the dashboard. Additionally, in the August of this last year, President Trump provided an executive order that really gave guidance for expedited review of major projects, identifying that the NEPA process on major projects across the board take far too long. So he wanted to push that effort across his administration to try and avoid duplication and expedite the project. And then we had our joint development agreement in November. We've been working, as I said, with FERC to answer their questions. We're anticipating any day now FERC to provide us with the published schedule, because we have met that 801 data request. In their last official correspondence to interested parties, they said once they receive the answers, they'll be publishing a schedule. So we want to hold them to that word. We're interfacing with the Trump administration and with folks in Washington to hopefully achieve that. So that's why we wanted to at least provide an update on our EIS and ultimately a record decision for the Alaska LNG. So next slide. Again, those interactions, as I said, with FERC have been numerous, and again, providing them with what they need to initiate their work effort to be in compliance with the law. What we have under the DOI, or Department of Interior, is we had, as of Monday, the new Assistant Deputy Secretary sworn in, a guy you all are familiar with, Joe Balash. So he is now in place. He now has the reins of that organization that includes the Bureau of Land Management, which impacts Alaska because there are many federal lands within Alaska. And we've taken the opportunity to, again, continue to keep Mr. Balash informed of the challenges that we are seeing as we go through the regulatory and land management processes within the Department of Interior, so that hopefully he can help us with affect some of the change. One of which is the granting to the state of Alaska of Public Land Order 5150. And that's been a long-standing issue between the federal government and the state of Alaska, and we hope that with Secretary Zinke and Joe Balash in place that we can achieve, if not the entire transmittal of that land back to the state of Alaska, at least the pipeline corridor that would be needed for the Alaska LNG project. And then, again, having folks in high places that can hopefully bring reasonableness and understanding of Alaska issues, one of which within the regulatory environment is below ground versus above ground pipeline construction, specifically on the North Slope south of Prudhoe Bay, mm-hmm. heading south. We're all used to having pipelines on VSMs. Those are hot oil lines. We want to put a chilled high-pressure natural gas pipeline and bury it in the ground so that it's safer and secure. So we're asking Department of Interior to help support that effort. Next slide. Under the EPA's jurisdiction, we had, as I last reported, we had an issue where there was some designation potentially of the Yukon River Basin, 200, 1,000 square miles of Alaska from the Canadian border to the Bering Sea that was designated a could be designated an aquatic resource of national importance. But luckily, the EPA did not follow through with that occurrence, and so we don't have that that jurisdiction placed on top of the state of Alaska. We see now with the new administration, another individual that came out of Juneau to the Region 10, Mr. Chris Sladek, is a person that has great knowledge of Alaskan issues and has a great knowledge of AGDC because he was a former board member under this administration. The major other federal permits that we need to acquire are, again, incidental take authorizations for marine mammal species within both the Beaufort Sea and Cook Inlet. We have engaged with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Divisions on making sure that we are meeting the requirements of obtaining that take authorization, because, again, it's going to be a requirement before we begin construction that we get that authorization so that the mammals are protected during that activity. And then, as I said earlier, the Army Corps with the Section 404 permit. We have applied for the 404 permit on the same alignment as our in-state natural gas pipeline, but including the LNG plant and the Cook Inlet crossing. So those are new additions to the 404 process that we're working in providing responses to the Corps. And then lastly, PHMSA, which is the Pipeline Hazardous Material and Safety Administration, we've applied for 5 special permits, and we're having to go through an environmental analysis for them to push those permits out to us. Next slide, please. So besides the federal authorizations, we also have state authorizations, primarily Title 16 habitat permits with Fish and Game, air permits with the DEC, the right-of-way grant by the Department of Natural Resources, and then certification by DEC of the Section 404 permit by the Army Corps, and ultimately material sales contracts and water authorizations by DNR so that we can obtain water and gravel to be able to build this project. So that is our interactions that we're now undertaking with the state agencies. Our goal is to be able to have those authorizations in hand by first quarter 2019 so that we're able to then reach a final investment decision, knowing full well that we have the regulatory environment in hand to be able to get to an FID and execute construction.
Couple questions?
Yes, sir.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was just curious. We've talked about this permitting before. I've asked about it several times. Do we have some Alaska Native Corporation lands that we need to cross, and where are we at dealing with that? That's actually private property, so I'm just curious where we're at with that.
Through the Chair, Representative Tallarico, on the alignment, we have approximately 40 miles of what we'll call private lands that include Engska Corporation lands, nearly 38 miles of which are owned by OTNA. Mm-hmm. So we have been in discussion with OTNA. Keith and I met with their board and executive team last week. So we're initiating a process to be able to go through a process to achieve a lease across OTNA lands.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Recently, there's been legislation introduced that would parallel the Stand for Salmon initiative, and we've had just anecdotal discussions and commentary about how devastating not only this initiative, but anything that would parallel that would be to development in Alaska construction. It's a very broad-based proposal, and I was wondering, in the context of this project, could you speak to, or have you had an opportunity to look at how that might impact this project, the permitting, because it seems like it's very, very comprehensive. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I'll ask if you turn the slide to slide 48. It identifies, again, the number of waterways that we are going to cross. We did do stream surveys, identified that 194 of those will contain anadromous fish, so those would be the Title 16 permits, and the remainder are water bodies that do not. So what that, from our perspective, the Title 16 permitting process is what we've initiated, and we're working with Fish and Game to make sure that we're putting in place the protections necessary to meet the statutory requirements that they have to administer. So I'm not sure what will come out of the legislative process or the initiative process, so it's hard to say
But any burden placed on additional permitting requirements will conceivably add risk to the project and potentially time. So that's something that we're trying to avoid, is making sure that we know full well what the risk environment is so that we can address it and do it in a timely fashion.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Well, just anecdotally, I mean, I've heard that, you know, you wouldn't be able to permit Prudhoe Bay and some of the development that's actually underway and that we've benefited from for, you know, 40-plus years, you know, were this process and this permitting demand to move forward. So, I mean, obviously that's of grave concern to me as an Alaskan, and I guess I would certainly hope that is weighing heavily on in your consideration, and I'm just wondering what's your next step forward, or how do you weigh in on that, or how do you evaluate that?
You want to take it or you want me?
Well, I'll go ahead if you're going to give it to me. To me, it's an important issue, and I think, you know, part of the importance is the language in the legislation that was proposed. Now, that's not the HB 199, which is, you know, I'm not that familiar with that language, but that kind of a thing could be very stifling to development. And I've had situations in my development career where there may be language that would suggest that a particular habitat may be home to a species, even though the species isn't there, but if the species were there, that's where it would want to be. I see something similar in this legislation, that any body of water is a place where a fish might want to be, and I see this shifting the burden of proof to prove that there's not a fish there. So we've talked about 194 streams that we cross out of the roughly, you know, 600 total that contain these fish, saying the others don't, but to prove that the others don't is a significant burden. So you know, we've sort of taken a position that we don't want to weigh in, you know, on any significant lightning rod issue for or against, but we did want to put it out there that I think this would be detrimental to development, not just on this project, but on any development project in the state.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you.
Actually, I know we're pressed for time, but let me ask you just real quickly, and a succinct answer is fine as far as I'm concerned. I think 199 speaks to substantial effects. If there's a potentiality for substantial effects, a major permit would be required. What was the plan, notwithstanding 199, if the line came, as it will, up to an anadromous stream? Was it to mitigate as best it could and preserve the stream? I mean, is there, I don't know if there's something you could help.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, again, the process that we go through with Fish and Game, again, is recognizing that there are anadromous fish streams, and then we have to identify how we are best going to cross that stream, whether it's going to be in the wintertime or summertime, what mitigation efforts we're going to put in place to be able to meet the requirements that Fish and Game would place on us under that Title 16 permit. So we have a toolkit, so to speak, of how we will address, based on the water body, based on the flow, based on the time of year, et cetera, on how we would achieve that.
Thank you. All right, we're down to, I'd say, 7 minutes or so. Can we get that done?
I can, Mr. Chairman. Again, next slide. I wanted to talk about the Kenai Spur Highway. This is a route that runs from essentially from Soldotna out through Kenai, down out to Nikiski, and out to Captain Cook Park. The sighting of the slide shows that the Kenai Spur Highway, that yellow line, runs right through the future site of the Alaska LNG plant. So we will have to reroute that highway to be able to go around the site. So as AGDC took on the project in early 2017, a lot of work had been done previously by the former project management team, and they had developed 13 different alternatives, and they put them on a map, and the locals call it the spaghetti map, because they couldn't determine what was going to happen, and folks are really concerned what it's going to mean to their own personal life and to their property and their way of life, so to speak. So we wanted to in advance of achieving construction, we wanted to be able to at least advance the work to bring it down to a couple preferred alternatives to be able to take it back to the community and represent to them what we would need to do to be able to meet the requirements of the not only the state of Alaska DOT, but the federal highway, because AGDC will build this road, but we want to hand it over to DOT to take on operation, and they rely on federal dollars, so they want to make sure it meets federal requirements. So we've incorporated that into the mix. We've come up with two alternatives. We're going to host a public hearing in Nikiski on February 12th. We're asking them for the public comment to be able to get their inputs to it, to be able to then take it ultimately to a preferred alternative before we then wait until we achieve that financial capability to execute on the project. Next slide, please. Similarly, we had the Matanuska-Susitna Borough wrote a letter recently to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission with a complaint that Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and the former project team of ExxonMobil had incorrectly considered siting of the LNG plant. And so what this refers to is the study of the site selection work that was really done in 2012 under the concept selection work by the former producer partners, looking at the sites for an LNG plant. And so at that time, under the Matsu Borough's port master plan, it identified major goals of using that port for resource development, extraction, and shipping, so it was going to be a full-use facility. And it was deemed at that point to be incompatible to place a full 20 million ton per year LNG plant on that site because it would have consumed it in total. So conversely, the team then looked in the general area of the Matsu port and chose a site what they called Point McKenzie, 3 miles to the north. Unfortunately, it was a challenge site because it had shallow water, and it would require a significant amount of work to be able to put in place the jetties for the LNG terminal. And it was on Native Corporation land, so there was potentially an issue with obtaining land ownership rights. So there was a process of and selection to develop the sites, ultimately leading to the Nikiski site. And so AGDC was recently asked whether or not we would consider the Matsu Borough becoming an intervener in the FERC process. We don't have any opposition to that because the pipeline route goes through 150 miles of borough land. They should have been an intervener from the start. So we're not opposing that, but we want to set the record straight that the Matsu port had previously supported the Nikiski site 100%, but they only wanted to make sure that their pipeline routing was considered coming closer to the port. So we've responded in kind to that. And at this point, if we were told to go back and look specifically at a comparable site analysis of Point McKenzie for the full 20 MTPA site, it would take considerable amount of time, considerable amount of energy, and so we would slow the process down. Now, that's not to say that that port site is not viable for a smaller scale LNG facility. It's just that we feel that at this point of time, we've done enough preliminary work, enough engineering work, that the Nikiski site is the preferred site to go forward with.
Continue.
Okay. Quickly on the ASAP, the In-State Natural Gas Pipeline Project, I referred to the Army Corps completing their final supplemental environmental impact statement in the March timeframe. That would lead to working on wetlands mitigation plans and ultimately for a record of decision coming from the Army Corps and the other federal agencies, which would grant us the authorization to construct. So that's a major milestone for AGDC to then have that for the ASAP project. Okay. Next slide, please. Previously, I talked about our support from the Trump administration working through his National Economic Council as well as his Council on Environmental Quality, his cabinet-level secretary's involvement in the likes of Secretary Ross working on the Joint Development Agreement and Secretary Zinke on land and permitting issues. And then also, finally, our congressional delegation. We're continuing to provide great support to us as we push for the FERC schedule to be executed. And then very quickly, Keith mentioned it earlier, but we had done some work looking specifically at strategic country sourcing, and we wanted to make sure that we were looking at the best way to achieve materials for the project. And so we looked at four primary countries, China, Japan, Korea, and the U.S., to look at the flow from raw materials through to fabrication, and were there opportunities then for cost savings by designating specific work activities in countries? For instance, the modules for the gas treatment plant. The ExxonMobil-led project team looked at major module fab yards around the Asian Pacific coast, and they were focused in on China. Well, China has upped its game, is producing hundreds of millions of tons of modules now, producing them at high-quality standards to be able to meet the international oil company work both offshore and onshore. So we've looked to see how that would best fit into a strategic sourcing. The outcome of that is we see there are potential savings of nearly $1.4 billion in terms of working with those countries who would then be ultimately buyers of the product, but also potentially investors in the product. And then lastly, the execution review, which was looking at the three main sub-projects, again, to see if there were opportunities to provide cost savings in the execution of the project.
We're going to run a couple more minutes, and I'll do a little housekeeping.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I can end on this slide. We were asked at the last meeting about the trumpet curve that the legislature is used to in regards to a stage gate process. So what we have done is represent that the concept selection portion was done between 2012 and 2014. The pre-FEED work was done between 2014 and 2016. And then, as I've described earlier, we're in the de-risking of the regulatory phase right now while we work with our commercial and financial partners to bring on funding to be able to execute then into the lump sum turnkey or FEED level of effort to reach a final investment decision in 2019. So there are new elements into this, the FEED decision, securing customers being number one, securing the gas being another, securing the lenders for the non-recourse debt finance, and then ultimately bring on board the capabilities of large engineering procurement and construction contractors to execute on the work. So next slide wraps it up, identifies that what we're going to be doing over the 2018-2019 timeframe. Again, rolling into a FEED rollover to lump sum turnkey with the major sub-projects of the LNG, the gas treatment plant, the pipeline, and compressors being the major portions of that work. Our major spend will be in the range of between $400 and $700 million.
So, ladies and gentlemen, here's what we're going to do relative to the PowerPoint. First of all, we've essentially completed it. However, the committee may have some follow-up questions, so I'm going to propose the following. Tomorrow, there's a lunch and learn that I'm sponsoring in the building somewhere. I assume at noon. And you can ask questions there. And then second, I'm going to ask the three of you, if you're, I know you're in town, I think tomorrow for a Senate Resources Committee presentation, if one or all of you, one would be, I think, satisfactory, are in town Friday and could be here at, you're not in town. So if one of you could be available by telephone at 1 p.m. on Friday, the 26th, we may have some questions for you, and then we're going to move on to another matter. But is that satisfactory?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We need 20 to 30 minutes.
20 to 30 minutes. So if there's no other business, I know, Representative Parrish, you have a question, but the next committee needs to come in. So I would ask it tomorrow at the Lunch and Learn or on Friday. We'll adjourn at 3:00.
So many
foods.
How are you doing?